state health officials with vaccination planning and operations, as well as providing logistical support to points of distribution across the state. As more vaccines become available to us, the Guard will then be ramping up to provide additional coordination and logistical support and to help us with the setup of mobile vaccination clinics. The Guard will also augment our rapid response teams to address outbreaks at nursing homes and other long-term care facilities. Throughout the crisis, the men and women of the Maryland National Guard have stepped up to provide critical support in a wide range of areas, including nursing home strike teams, building hospital surge capacity, transporting and transferring tests and PPE and critical supplies from the National Strategic National Stockpile, and even helping with the distribution of school lunches. We're very fortunate to have these elite citizen soldiers and airmen to call on. And once again, we're going to be utilizing them as we launch what will be the largest and most important vaccination campaign in the history of our state and our nation. We are also ramping up an aggressive public outreach effort, briefing our congressional delegation, the leaders of the General Assembly, county leaders, faith-based leaders, and community stakeholders. And soon we will be launching statewide public service announcements regarding the safety and importance of these COVID vaccinations. It will take many weeks to fully ramp up the production and distribution of vaccines, and we still have some tough times to go through. But these vaccines really do offer us real hope that we are approaching the final phase of this global pandemic. As of today, Maryland has had 239,362 confirmed cases of COVID-19. We have now experienced 42 straight days with more than 1,000 cases. Our current 7-day statewide positivity rate is 7.53%, and our cases per 100,000 is at 46.4, which is the 9th lowest in America. A total of 23,711 COVID patients have been hospitalized in Maryland, including 1,799 currently hospitalized as of today, which is our highest total ever. That number includes 411 COVID patients currently in intensive care. 88% of staffed acute and ICU beds are currently occupied statewide. 13 Maryland hospitals have both acute and ICU bed capacity, which is at or above 90%. 146 patients are currently in surge beds at the alternate care sites, which we added back in the spring. In addition, we are closely monitoring active cases at 189 of our nursing homes and at 142 of our assisted living facilities. Vaccinations will be distributed to all 227 nursing homes in the next 2 weeks. As of today, the state of Maryland has conducted 5.1 million COVID-19 tests. The backbone of Maryland's long-term testing strategy have been the lab genomics tests, which we acquired from South Korea as part of Operation Enduring Friendship, and in spite of numerous false partisan attacks and a coordinated disinformation campaign, we are pleased to report that as of today, the state of Maryland has successfully utilized every single one of these 500,000 tests. We use them every single day at our community-based testing sites, as well as for our nursing homes, congregate care settings, clusters, outbreaks, and hotspots all across the state. And I'm proud to announce today that as a result of this tremendous success, a partnership between the Korean company, Lab Genomics, and the Maryland-based Scion Diagnostics in Frederick has resulted in a new agreement for the acquisition of a million more Korean tests. As a result, these lab genomic tests and these two great companies will be continuing to save lives and to make a real difference on the front lines here in our state. We want to again thank the Republic of Korea and Lab Genomics for coming to our aid when we desperately needed it back in the darkest days of the crisis. The people of Maryland owe a profound debt of gratitude to them and to the people of South Korea. With vaccine distribution now beginning in our state, we have finally reached a turning point, and we are able to see the sun rising on the horizon, even if that horizon may still seem a little bit distant right now. I want to assure the people of Maryland that we will get through this together, and that every single day, as we vaccinate more and more people, and as we continue to fight this virus with everything we've got, that it will bring us much closer to that victory over this deadly virus. With that, at this time, I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Chan to provide you with some more details and to update you on the latest developments regarding vaccination distribution plans.
Thank you, Governor. I'm pleased to be with you here today to provide an update on the status of the vaccination implementation here in Maryland. With the FDA approval of the Pfizer COVID-19 vaccine just this last Friday, distribution of vaccines has begun across the country and here in Maryland as well. As the governor said, this is a momentous time for all of us in the course of this pandemic as we continue all of our response efforts around testing, contact tracing, hospital surge. We know there is that light at the end of the tunnel. We also know that having a safe and effective vaccine will be this important tool to prevent further disease and hospitalizations, especially among our most vulnerable. As the governor alluded to, yesterday, among the first to be vaccinated at the University of Maryland was a nurse, Sean Hendricks. She is the nursing director of medicine, cardiac services at the University of Maryland Medical Center. And she has been there for over 20 years, starting as a nursing student. She noted that African Americans are more likely to contract the virus. And she was among the first employees to be vaccinated. So I wanted to provide a situational update. So as we've discussed, initial shipments of vaccine as part of the state's first allocations have begun to arrive. And over the course of the next 2 weeks, all hospitals will have vaccines to begin vaccination of their critical frontline staff. Also within the next 2 weeks, nursing homes will have their vaccination programs begin in partnership with CVS and Walgreens. I want to emphasize that in these early stages, as we are beginning the implementation of our vaccination program, that there will be limited doses that we have available to Maryland. However, with this initial allocation of 155,000 doses of both the Pfizer and the Moderna vaccines, this will be dedicated and allocated to healthcare workers in hospitals and nursing homes. While our projected allocation is up to 300,000 doses by the end of this month, the information from federal partners can change, and actually even on a daily basis, so that the availability and the actual amount of doses that we have to be able to order may change from week to week. But with this initial allocation that's coming to Maryland, our phase 1A, the primary focus will be on healthcare workers and residents of nursing homes, as well as first responders, as is recommended by our federal partners at the CDC. While the focus right now is on those hospitals and nursing homes, as we're allocated more vaccines in the coming weeks, we will be able to expand further into the 1A population and make it available for other healthcare workers in non-hospital or non-nursing home settings. We anticipate that with ongoing allocations to the state, we will be able to expand further to include people in high-risk categories, those who are at risk of complications from COVID-19 disease in Phase 1B. And Phase 2 is when we begin to be able to open up availability and access to vaccine for our critical essential workers. And our draft plan puts educators and childcare providers within that phase. There are other vaccines in right now in the late stages of clinical trials, and we anticipate, again, in the coming weeks and months, that those vaccines will also be approved, and that will also increase availability of vaccine to Marylanders. But for the moment, I wanted to review again what we know about the Pfizer vaccine that was just approved, and what we also know about the Moderna vaccine that's being considered this week. So again, as we talked a little bit about last week, the FDA took the Pfizer data and reviewed it and did their own analysis. And the analysis that they did independently of the Pfizer manufacturer scientists continued to show that there was 95% efficacy of the vaccine to prevent COVID disease among people who received the vaccine. So while they applied for the emergency use authorization on November 20th, and they were approved, just as I said, this past Friday. So one of the important things with Moderna is that they are also showing high efficacy of 94% in terms of preventing COVID disease among people who received the vaccine. Right now, the FDA scientists have been doing their own independent analysis of the Moderna vaccine, and that data was released today. Thursday, the FDA's advisory committee will be meeting to review this data analysis and make a recommendation to the FDA. Assuming that their review continues to corroborate the information that has been shared with us to date, then we anticipate that as soon as Friday, the FDA will issue an emergency use authorization for the Moderna vaccine.
So welcome back. That was just Governor Hogan's presser on the vaccine. We received a lot of information that a lot of it's familiar with us. If we've been keeping up, it's familiar. So Dr. Chin kind of gave her second update on the vaccination distribution plans. Vaccinations have begun this week. They currently anticipate that every hospital will receive their first two doses within the next 2 weeks, and nursing home vaccinations will start within the next 2 weeks. So there's a little bit of a debate going on my Facebook page where people are like, you know, there's some people who need more information because they don't trust vaccines. And we have been doing a lot on this show. We've been talking a lot about the vaccines. We have been. We just want to give all the information that we're getting about this. And there's another camp of people, India Creek. She's like, I've been getting vaccines all my life. So, yes, I'm going to get this one as well. It is a decision that you have to make. And it's not something that we are telling you should take. I've said every step of the way, I'm giving you information so you can make the best decision for your family, for your life. And the areas that I felt uncomfortable about, and I have been very clear about that, that under 18 population has me concerned. Because there's no trial data on that. We've had epidemiologists and infectious disease specialists confirm what I feel and what I thought. There's not enough information. But the over 18 population, they've been doing it. When I have people who are actually in the trial study, Dr. Freeman Rabowski is in the trial study. Nurse Hendricks and Nurse Hendricks has actually got the vaccine. Dr. Henry actually got the vaccine. So you're going to have to make the best decision for your family. Do that and then move forward with whatever you're going to do. Let's talk about what's going on in our community. A study came out from T. Rowe Price that said black families prioritize money conversations with children more than any other racial groups. That black folks, we talk with our children more about saving money, about spending wisely, about setting financial goals, and about family finances. They did a sampling in their 12th annual Parent, Kids, and Money survey that says that out of all the ethnic groups, black folks, we're the ones talking to our children frequently about money, that these conversations, these discussions are powerful drivers for building financial capabilities in adulthood. So even though we have a racial wealth gap that exists in our country, it's complex, it's intertwined with history, it's hard to unpack. I know there are outliers, but black folks actually have less money than white folks in this country, period. I'm not talking about Oprah. You know, take out Oprah, take out Michael Jordan, take out LeBron James, and put in the rest of us. The rest of us are operating right now with a racial wealth gap that was already quite wide when you think about the amount of money. And you compare it across races, the racial wealth equity gap has gotten so large that at this point, they don't know when it's going to close. It was already getting wider before COVID-19. Hear me out. Before COVID-19, we were talking about how much money each community spent and how much money did the white community spend on property and the Hispanic community on property versus the black community on property and the Asian American community on property, life insurance, all these things. We talked about this before COVID-19. Remember, we said before COVID-19 that there were a couple things that we were recommending that you do. Hey, you need to own your home and you need to own the land, right? Because it's not just about owning the home. You need to make sure you own your land as well. We talked about having some savings, making sure that you're paying yourself first. We talked about, you know, teaching your children good money skills and good money habits, that we don't spend everything we have just because we have it, but also that we're setting ourselves up to lay a foundation for generational wealth building. That when we die, we pass our home and the land on to our children. They can either keep it and live in it, or they can sell it and they can use the money. What we've been advising our sons to do is, whether they like their childhood home or not, right? We've said, don't sell the house. When daddy and I are gone, don't sell. That's the first thing people do. They sell the house and split the money. We've told them, keep the house and have the home as a form of equity so that future generations can borrow against the home so they can build their own wealth. I said, that's what you want to do. Don't sell it. Because once you sell it, you get $20. You get 10, your brother get 10, that's gone. You keep that home, it continues to appreciate in value. You keep the home up, you keep the home going. You can get a renter in there, so then you have money coming in. But you take the money from the life insurance, pay off the house, and then you're renting the house and you're bringing in an income. I said, there's a way we can do that. Don't think short term in terms of the money. Think long term. I said, one of the things long term is we want your grandchildren, our grandchildren, to be able to have property in the family that they can borrow against. We bought our house using the Teacher Next Door program. I was a teacher when we bought our house. And Baltimore City, Mayor Scott, I'm calling you because I don't know if that program's still in effect, but they used to have the teacher next door, the police officer next door, and the firefighter next door program, where you can buy a house. There's certain houses on the list. You buy the house, Baltimore City would put up half the cost of the house. You would put up the other half the cost of the house. And then after 3 years, the equity that they paid for, it becomes balloon equity in your house. So for example, just to break this down so we're all on the same page, our house costs $30. We paid $15. The city paid $15. Once we lived in the house for 3 years, that $15 from the city became equity in our house. And we're just paying off our $15. That program still exists. If you are a city teacher, look at the Teacher Next Door program. If you are a police officer, look at the Officer Next Door program. It's a way that you can build equity in your house very quickly. We have not used the equity. I'm telling my sons that equity builds up. Pay off our $15. Then you have $30 that you can borrow against, you can keep, you can make money off of. I want to talk about that more when we come back. How are you talking to your children about financial savings, spending, buying, selling? How are you having these financial conversations with your children? We'll talk about that, and we'll get to Anthony when we return.
Christmas is one of my favorite times of the year. It's a time of joy, laughter, and peace on earth and goodwill toward men. I'm grateful this holiday season for the awesome opportunity to serve the WEAA family. My Christmas wish is for your continued good health and prosperity throughout the new year. As we express our gratitude this holiday season, we must never forget that the highest appreciation is not to utter words, but to live by them. Merry Christmas and a very happy new year.
This is Ernestine Jones. I invite you to join me on Sunday mornings, 5 a.m. until 7 a.m. And don't forget the prayers at the top of the hour, that's 6 o'clock a.m., and the spiritual thought at 6:10. It'll keep you motivated and help you throughout the week. All of your classics also. I am truly the voice of the community. That's what WEAA is, 88.9 FM. We love you, Baltimore. For more of the yard.
Listen live to your favorite public radio station. Streaming now at WEAA.org.
Okay, I'm Dr. K. Wise Whitehead. Folks, we're talking about a study by T. Rowe Price that says that Black families prioritize money conversations with their children more than any other racial group. I want to just note, as we're having this conversation, I invite you to call. How are you talking to your children about money? We talk to our sons all the time. I've been fussing is a word they would use. I would say advising. I've been advising my oldest son to stop spending so much money. There's a global pandemic. Why are you buying new tennis shoes during a global pandemic? He is working during this time, and I understand he says that, you know, it's through the bind that he looks forward to whatever's going to happen in the future. But we keep talking to him about saving. Save your money. Put your money to work for you. But also about getting some skin in the game for your own education. See, he's been doing college from our kitchen table, from his room and from his desk. I'm like, when you go back next spring, when you go back, you got to have some skin in the game. 2021 is about skin in the game. You've been working. You've been making money. You should not have to call home for money. We got tuition. All that other stuff is on you. You've got to put some skin in the game, because maybe in putting some skin in the game, you'll start to value your education more. You say you want to buy a car. Where's your skin in the game? We had to just put my oldest son on our insurance. Our insurance doubled with him on it. He's 19 years old. And because he's 19, when I got the bill, we went from our age with, you know, 20 years of good driving records, right? So we were paying a small amount of money, very happy with our insurance, paying $250, feeling really good about that. Put my oldest son, 19 years old, on our insurance. And it doubled. And so we're having this conversation because I believe, and I want to ask you, 410-319-8888, I believe that my son needs to pay half of the cost of his insurance. I'm like, okay, your insurance for one person because you're 19 is $250. You should be paying half. And when you go back to college, we will be dropping you down to the lowest amount for us just to keep your name on here. But you will not be covered. So which means you can't go down driving anybody's car. What are the conversations you're having with your children about financial wealth? Because right now, the net worth of a typical white family is $171,000. The net worth of a typical black family is $17,150, 10 times greater in the white community. And that was before COVID. COVID-19 has devastated our community. So we know that gap is going to be much greater. We have Anthony on the phone from Columbia. Anthony, how are you?
Hi, Dr. K. Good to hear your voice.
Yes, thanks for calling.
Thanks for taking my call. You know, Dr. K, I'm going to just introduce a man who I know you know very well. Baltimore's own, Gone for Not Forgotten, Reginald F. Lewis.
Yes.
He wrote a book, and I would recommend every African-American, male or female. Title of his book was, Why Should White Guys Have All the Fun? You have got to read this book. Now, this man, very smart, got into Harvard Law School, you know, and he figured out, once he started seeing what, I'll throw out a name, Michael Milken. I'm sure you know that name.
Oh, yes.
He thought, why in the world am I going to continue to practice law when I can make some real money without having to work for it?
Yep.
Before he passed away, he donated $3 million to Harvard University, and they named a building after him.
Oh, yes. And we have the Reginald F. Lewis Museum for Maryland African American History and Culture right downtown.
And I'll also pass this along, because I know you have other callers waiting. If you know, everyone loves Tesla. Well, not everyone. Most folks would love to own a Tesla. Don't love to own the Tesla. Own the stock.
There you go.
If people had bought Tesla back in January, when it was $80 a share, $80 in January. Today, same year, it's over $600. So we have really got to get into this, as you say, get some skin in the game.
Get some skin in the game. Or we're being left behind. Get some skin in the game.
And that real estate, I know a white woman once told me, she said, you know what, they're always going to build houses, Anthony, but they don't build land.
Nope. Get your land. Own your house. And see, here's the thing, Anthony. I didn't know that. My dad is the one that told us. He had us go back and look at our contract before we signed it. He said, you need to make sure you're buying your land because they'll give you a contract for the house and not the land. You want the land.
Right. You want the land. You got to have the land.
Yeah, you got to have the land. Thank you so much, Anthony. Folks, that book by Reginald F. Lewis, who, by the way, put money aside for the Reginald F. Lewis Museum of Maryland African American History and Culture. You know, you can go right on downtown and go and visit it. It is an amazing place, and I know they're practicing social distancing, but it's something for you to take a look at. His book, Why Should White Guys Have All the Fun? How Reginald Lewis Created a Billion-Dollar Business Empire. We have Jeffrey from Randallstown. Jeffrey, how are you?
Hey, good morning. Well, good evening.
Good
how
evening.
Are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for calling.
All right. Now, we know each other, and you know my girls like I know your boys.
Yes.
Let me tell you, I think one of the key things is two key things I believe in. Number one, we as a people, as African Americans, need to learn to trust a process.
Right.
Because in this case, when you said you have to do things, I believe you said something about you have to do things to make money without actually working. Somebody you cited.
Right. Oh, Reginald Lewis talked about that.
Okay. Yeah. And that's great. But the problem is, most of us don't trust what we can't see.
Right.
If the transaction isn't happening, I can't do it. There's so many people. Not me personally, but people can't do it. There's so many people that are involved in things like Primerica. It's a great system. But a lot of people don't trust it because, hey, how do I see my money happening? If they can't see the transaction going on, or they're not patient enough for the long term of the transaction, because we are about, as a people, we are about instant gratification.
No,
so
if
we're not getting that gratification,
speak it.
You're not going to have anybody trusting investing my money so that over time it builds money. Hey, I'm hungry. I want to get paid now. That's the attitude.
Now, let me ask you this, Jeffrey. Let me ask you this, because this is a conversation we often have in our household. And we talk about whether or not our people are dealing with immediate gratification because we come from a history of not having. So when you don't have, you want yours at that moment. Like, how do we then train, help, nurture our children to go for the long haul?
You have to instill in them the education of an example, whether white or black, that people make money over the long haul. You have to cite the history of families, saying plainly, hey, this man came, like, for instance, as despicable as they are as a group now, people like the Koch brothers. When they first got here as immigrants to the United States, they weren't rich at all. Most of the billionaires that you know, or billionaire families that you know of, they weren't rich at all. They worked hard to get the money to start, but then they passed it on, kept it in family,
right.
Kept the property in family.
Right, but if you're talking about a cycle of poverty, though, Jeffrey, if you're talking about a cycle of poverty, there's so many African-American households that are economically challenged that actually can't afford to take a risk. Like, I want to put my money and have my money work for me, but I have my mortgages due today, or my rent's due today, or I need food today, or why should my child have skates when everybody else has a bike? I mean, it comes down. As Nikki Giovanni said, I mean, those are Nikki Giovanni's words. She's like, you know what? I want my child to have a bike. So it means that I may have to take a little bit of money from my savings because I don't want my child to be the only one on skates.
Agreed, but you have to make the sacrifice of understanding.
Yeah.
Like you said with your son with brand new tennis shoes.
Yeah.
Boy, don't borrow him by $250 Jordan.
Come on.
Buy a pair of tennis shoes. I got no problem with that. But don't go out here buying $250 Jordans that you know are going to wear out just as fast as every
Come
other
on.
Pair of tennis shoes out there.
Come on, I'm with you.
And if you don't see the value of that, and it takes the kid to grasp it. Even though we can teach it, because you know that old adage, you can lead a horse to water, you know the rest.
Yeah.
So we can instill in them what it is, but it's up to them to make the choice. And unfortunately, we as parents have to step back and say, you know, you made the wrong choice. And I'm telling you not to make the choice. And guess what? It pains me to see you make that choice.
But you need to go through it so you can learn from that choice.
And watch this. Here's the killer. The faster they learn that choice, the better. And I also think, and I've said this millions of times, I say it to my own girls, you know, the benefit, well, this is a difference that I notice. Boys and girls aren't raised the same.
You sound like what Michelle Obama said.
I'm just saying, a lot of boys aren't given the responsibility that girls are instantly given at the same age. I mean, I can testify going back 30 years myself to high school, I knew girls who had bank accounts.
You got to get them ready. I got to stop you there, Jeffrey. I appreciate you. Now, folks, Jeffrey said something that a friend of mine in Atlanta, Clive, said. He said, if you have the credit, put your child on your credit card. Give them their own credit card and give them a limit to teach them how to spend and save. Now, I want to make a note, right? Because, look, y'all, this is probably coming off sounding a little classist, right? I think we have to be clear about the way in which we're approaching this, right? The way in which we're talking about this, because we understand that people who are coming from economically challenged households, you know, won't have all this money to share with your children and teach them lessons, but the lessons have to be learned. You've learned from your mistakes, even pass on the mistakes to them. Now, I have Renee on the phone from T. Rowe Price, who can give us a little bit of insight into the study about that T. Rowe Price did around how black families prioritize money conversations with their children more than other racial groups. Renee, how are you?
Dr. K.
I'm doing well, thank you. Thank you so much for chiming in. And Renee Kristoff is the head of Global Association Engagement plus Corporate Responsibility at T. Rowe Price. Can you talk with us about this study? Because we're unpacking it in terms of the ways in which black families are talking to their children more about money issues.
Sure. We do this study every year, and this is the 12th time we've done the study. And in the past, we had not had a big enough audience of people of color, black parents in particular. But because we enlarged our sample size, we now were able to do some cuts to really look at, you know, how are races talking differently, behaving differently around money. And we found that black parents tend to talk about money conversations more, but they also talk about a lot of other conversations as well. So they talk about sex more often, they talk about screen time, physical activity, and drugs. So they're used to having the talk, if you will.
Okay, so let's break this down. They talk about money, you saw that, but we usually talk about sex around what, making sexual choices? Okay.
Absolutely, about how much screen time their children mm-hmm. have, about physical activity and drugs. We just found that interesting, even though the research was around money. We did ask, well, what else do you have conversations around with your children? And on all of those topics, black parents talked more about those topics than other parents did.
Now, let's talk a little bit about giving an allowance, because I hear that a lot in my house. I do. I have folded, Renee, to the pressure. So my son gets an allowance. But talk about allowances in the black community.
Sure. And we didn't get a lot of data on allowances, but parents do give allowances. And I don't have the report in front of me, but I certainly could find that out for you if you were interested. But I think the thing that all parents need to understand about allowances is, why are you giving it, first of all? Are you giving it because, you know, you want folks to be paid for chores, for doing things like that? So the key about an allowance is, what's your objective in terms of giving it? But many people give it just so that their kids can get some practice managing with money. And it's a small amount, so you only can do so much damage. But you give it so they can practice, right? They can practice, what does it mean to spend wisely? What does it mean to save? Because remember, it's not just about saving. You're saving for a goal or an objective. And when you reach that goal or objective, you should be able to spend those dollars on that goal or objective, or wait for a bigger goal or objective if the time comes, you have the money, and you decide, I've changed my mind, I want to do something else. But we find a lot of parents do give allowances, even though it's small amounts, just so the kids can practice and not be practicing on mommy and daddy's money all the time.
And that's interesting, because we do. We give my youngest son gets an allowance. We don't give my older son an allowance. You have a job. Your job,
right.
You mean, I'm saying, you're getting an allowance every 2 weeks, right? So for the child that doesn't have a job, I do make more allowances to give him an allowance. We don't talk to him. We talk a lot about savings, but his allowance is so small. The only thing we always push is, you got to pay your tithes and offerings. You pay your tithes and offerings, and then, you know, then you have a little bit more to spend. But when it comes to the other part of the study, this is the part that concerns me, Renee. Fewer black parents have retirement savings. See, that's the other part. Can you talk a bit about that?
Yeah, and sometimes it's because either they can't afford to take advantage of an employer's savings plan, or they might work for an employer that doesn't have a savings plan. And so it's up to you as an individual. If you're working somewhere that doesn't offer a retirement plan, you can certainly open up an IRA on your own. Even if you're only putting $50 a month, it is something. It's a place to start. But that is absolutely critical, because the government cannot fund your retirement. The government can fund your kids' student, you know, education. You can get student loans, but nobody gives you a loan to be in retirement, right? And so we are responsible for our own retirement. And that would be my suggestion, is if you don't have a retirement plan at your employer, make one for yourself. Build it for yourself. Start small. If you do have one, you should take advantage of it, because many times people leave money on the table. So if your employer gives you, say, a dollar-for-dollar match, for every dollar Renee puts in, my employer gives me another dollar, I'm leaving a dollar on the table for every dollar I would put in. So put that $50 in a pay so that you can get that other $50. Now you're at $100. But a lot of people, and I know that a lot of young people, leave that money on the table. When you're young, that's the time to do it, right? You can do a little bit of money,
right,
and you have time on your side. The time horizon you know, the compounding of dollars, that's all on your side when you're young. When you're older, you've got to catch up or make up for, you know, the deficiencies in your savings. It's a lot harder.
And you get, and you actually have to be more aggressive. I mean, I've been with my company for 13 years, and I know when they start, when I first started there, they did an 11-to-1 match, and it was like, yes, go hard,
that's
right?
Great.
But then 11-to-1 dropped to 9-to-1. I was like, okay, 9-to-1. I think it might be 3-to-1 now. I mean, COVID. And we've noticed that it's dropped, but it was good. I was like, you know, when it started, when I first got there, I was aggressive. Thinking, okay, long term, we're going to have to eat beans for a while to get us to where, because I want to eat beans now when I'm young and I can eat beans and stay up all night. Then when I'm retired, I'm like, I really want to be able to relax a little bit in my retirement. Are you finding that people have to work longer now?
They do. A lot of people work longer, some by choice, because they're, you know, people are more energetic. You know, we take better care of ourselves. You have more energy, more enthusiasm. And people just really, you know, it gives you something to do, right? Let's be honest. It is something to do. Some people struggle in retirement. But, yeah, they also have to work longer because they don't have what they need. When they sit down and run the numbers, they know they're not going to be able to continue paying for the mortgage that they have. They may have to downsize their housing. They may not want to do that. If they have the luxury of having, you know, another home, some people have that luxury, you might not be able to afford that, you know, summer cottage somewhere that you thought you could get in retirement. You're not able to do those things. And so it's best to begin to run the numbers before you actually retire. Run the numbers 5 years in advance, 4 years. Keep running those numbers to understand, well, what do I really need in retirement? And remember, you're not buying lunch in retirement. You're not buying clothes to wear to the office. So the expenses do go down. And sometimes people forget that.
Now, that's interesting because we were having a hard conversation because one of the things on the list is that Black people are less likely to have a mortgage. So we own our home, but we had to have a hard conversation, Renee. Where we've said that the time for our mini mansion has come and gone. Like, that's what we have said. We laugh about that, you know, because I always want, like, the big mini mansion. But I have a 19-year-old and an 18-year-old. So I'm sitting here thinking, they're going to be out of here when COVID ends or in the college. So I told my husband, I said, I think the time for the mini mansion for you, me, and Bella Red's my dog. I think that time has come and gone.
Right.
To think about taking on a huge house with three people. I mean, I'm counting Bella Red as a person, but she's clearly a 110-pound dog. But
she has the run of the house.
She has the run of the house, right? So can you talk about those choices around, you know, figuring out where you are in your time span, in your lifespan, where you are on the continuum for the kind of purchases that you're making?
That's right. I think you make a really good point. Your time horizon is really important. When you're young, you've got, you know, God willing, you have all the time in the world. And you make certain decisions and certain choices. When you get older and as you age, you really need to think about, how much time do I have if I make a bad decision? How much time do I have to recover before I have to retire? And many people have to retire because of their health. They don't want to retire because they know they don't have enough money. And many times we are forced out of the workplace because of our health. And nothing more than that. It's not our employer asking us to leave. It's not our desire to leave. We just can't do the work anymore because we just don't have, you know, our health is in a bad condition. And we have to be careful about that because our longevity as Black people is shorter in many cases than Caucasian. And so, again, what's a reasonable time horizon to be thinking about? How many years are you going to live in retirement? You have to plan for that as well so that your money doesn't run out. And so that's a whole other series of calculations to say, you know, I'll make up a number. Every year I need $30,000 to cover, you know, my health care, my housing, my food, you know, clothing, whatever else. And then those other little, you know, incidentals that happen. If you continue to own a home, your roof might go, right? So you need an emergency.
Oh, word.
And so how long can that last for 20 years? You got to run those numbers. And then you've got to be investing, right? You made a point earlier about being aggressive. You cannot afford to not have some equity exposure in your holdings, even in retirement, because you've got to be able to make up some numbers, right? You've got to be able to get some return on your dollar. So sitting it in a savings account is not the answer. You really do have to think through. It's a lot of things to think about.
You're depressing me here, Renee.
Oh, no. This should be giving you hope because now you've got this information. You can go away and work with your husband and run the numbers.
I'm telling you, we got to run the numbers.
They have all kinds of calculators out there that you can use to, you know, run the numbers, retirement calculators. We've created them. And it really does help you. You don't have to do it all on your own, right? We're not mathematicians and statisticians. You're not an insurance broker who says, okay, based on life expectancy tables, you're going to live to be 79.2 years. We don't know what how long we're going to live. And so you have to say, hey, I'm going to take the worst possible case scenario. And we typically use 90 years. We say you're going to live 90 years and you work for that towards that number. What does that look like? And you know what? If you don't make it to 90, you probably lived a good life because you're able to, you know, be a little bit more comfortable because you were a little bit more strict in how you were, you know, calculating.
I like that. So you calculate. Now, here's the thing I want to ask you about, because, you know, when you talk about, you know, black people in the mortgage and you talk about, you know, planning life insurance, because my husband and I, we're having this conversation now because we have term life insurance goes to 75. And so we're now thinking, oh, we need to start looking to transfer it over from term to whole. Whole life insurance is more expensive.
Yeah.
So, I mean, these are big conversations because you're thinking, all right, my plan, if I'm going 90, that means that I'm not 75 actually is working against me now.
Because
I have that term life insurance.
Because it's done at 75.
Yeah.
And you might have another 15, you know, who knows, 25
I mean, really.
Years. I had an aunt that went to 101.
Oh, my word.
I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah. Aunt Rosa was great. She's very good at
girlfriend rolled on.
Right. And so you, the insurance thing is a whole other conversation because it's really based on your personal needs and desires and, you know, who are you insuring, right? You don't insure your children because you're insuring, for the most part, people insure each other, husband, spouse, and family members to cover loss of income, right? So you never insure your children. It doesn't make any sense to do that because you're not covering any income for your children. They're not the ones bringing home income, so you don't do that. But you have to decide, is the insurance to, is it covering someone's salary? How much do we need, right? And for how long? If you have young children, you've got a longer time horizon because if they're 5 years old versus 19 years old, you need more money. You need a bigger insurance policy to cover those little people. And should, you know, the spouse or the partner become deceased, then you need to cover that income. But if your children are adults, a lot of times they have these new policies now where you can take your existing policy and you can change, alter that policy because you no longer need that amount of money because your kids are out, they're grown, they're not expecting to get income from you from that perspective.
Yeah, that's a good
point.
And so
you can cash that in and take that money and use it in retirement.
And that is something actually that's the conversation we're having now because we took out, and I know people call them, but we took out our life insurance policy. We were living in New York. The day after 9/11, I don't think we were the only ones, but the day after 9/11, everybody was calling their life insurance company going, give me as much as I can get.
Right.
Because 9/11 made you realize that mortality is something that needs to be part of your conversation. But my sons were young, a year or two years old. I'm thinking now they're 18 and 19. Now we have to start thinking 75 if we want to live to 90.
Right.
75 is not going to be, we have to start thinking now about changing term to whole and then being able to pay the bump and how much it's going to cost.
That's right. That's right. And so what are you willing to give up, right? That's the other conversation that we teach children in our program is to look at trade-offs. What do I have to give up today to get what I want in the future? And many adults haven't learned that lesson, that I can't have everything now and that I have to give up some things today to get some better things, bigger things, nicer things in the future. And so, you know, that's part of that conversation as well. But we were really pleased to see that black parents are having these conversations. We wanted to bring it to people's attention, but we also wanted to look at this from the perspective of they're having the conversations, but that doesn't mean that we don't have a wealth gap, right? So having the conversation is great, but it doesn't translate into us having money and us having wealth. And so why not, right? So you talked about home ownership. So you can build wealth in your home, right? The equity in your home becomes wealth. But if I don't have a home, I can't build wealth that way.
Right.
If I am stuck with a lot of student loans, I can't build wealth because I'm paying the student loan off, right? We also find we don't have legacy and intergenerational wealth transfer in our community as much as other communities. Our folks do not necessarily leave us money when they are deceased and when they pass on. You know, some have insurance, which is great, but they may only had enough to bury them, right, or to pay their bill. And so that's another way that we may not be able to accumulate wealth because we don't even get that little baseline. Even if somebody left you $10,000,
right,
that, and it sounds like a small amount, but if you weren't expecting that and you were 20 years old and somebody left you $10,000 and you invested that, that would be a nice chunk of change by the time you were 50 or 60 years old, right? So we don't even get that as an opportunity sometimes. Some do, some don't. But those are the things that begin, you can, you know, begin to outline what prevents us or prohibits us from closing that wealth gap.
I like that. Oh, I'm telling you. So we need to get you back on here, sister, so we can have a longer conversation. Renee Kristoff is the head of Global Association Engagement and Corporate Responsibility at T. Rowe Price. I got a lot of work. There's a storm coming tonight, so I can run my numbers tonight. Planning to live till 9. I'm going to go ahead and claim that. Thank you so much, Renee. We appreciate you.
Thank you, and I appreciate talking to your audience. Thank you so much.
Absolutely.
Bye-bye.
Can we get one more caller in here, Justina? Let's get Clark in here. Clark, you've been holding on. Thank you.
Yes. Hey, Dr. K.
Hey.
I just wanted to say about your 19-year-old. He wants a ride so he can drive to work. He needs to sacrifice the money and buy a ride and pay his own insurance.
There you go. Come on.
All right. That's
come on.
Part of growing up and manhood, because he wants to ride and profile.
Come on.
And, you know,
lean back and play his music. Come on, brother. Speak
and it. Impress the girl. Well, man up.
That's what I'm saying.
Stop riding on mom and dad.
That's what I'm saying.
Go to work.
Or get on the bus.
I can't tell you how many $400 cars I had when I started driving at 18 years old.
That's how I started. So he's.
Right.
I'm hoping he's listening. I'm going to make sure I pass your message on to him, Clark. I appreciate
right.
you. So, folks, stay safe. Tomorrow there's a storm coming. If it is brewing, don't worry. Tune in at 3 o'clock. We're going to be here, and we'll keep you nice and warm and comfortable. It's been an honor and a privilege to serve you this way. Keep it here for the Culture with Faraji.